When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hey, everybody. This is Douglas Burdett, host of the Marketing Book Podcast, and this is another special bonus episode. As longtime listeners know, each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, but occasionally I toss in a bonus episode like this one, so there's no extra charge. I'm kidding. This is a free podcast. But if you want to send me a bottle of wine, I'm not going to send it back, if you know what I mean. I was recently interviewed by my friend Josh Feinberg on his new B2B Digitized podcast, and he is such a smart, thoughtful interviewer that I wanted to share the interview with you and let you know about his new show. Enjoy the conversation and let the bonus begin.
Welcome to the B2B Digitized podcast, where leaders of B2B technology startups and scale-ups learn how to use digital transformation to differentiate, educate, build trust, improve competitive positioning, close sales faster without compromise, and scale revenue growth. Now, here's your host, Joshua Feinberg from SP Home Run.
Hi, I'm Joshua Feinberg from the B2B Digitized podcast, and I have with me today a very special guest and good friend, Douglas Burdett, who is host of the Marketing Book podcast and founder of Artillery, a marketing consultancy based in Norfolk, Virginia. Douglas, thanks so much for joining me for the podcast. Welcome.
Good to reconnect with you, and say hi to Jennifer for me.
I definitely will, for sure. So, I think the first place to start, what I'm super curious about is I've known
you. Okay, I know what you're going to ask. Those charges were dropped, Josh. Okay. You're not going to ask that? Oh, I'm sorry.
The first place I wanted to start is I've known you probably about 7 or 8 years. What led you to originally want to start a podcast about marketing and sales books? And I know it was originally marketing, but it's morphed into the critical relationship that marketing and sales now enjoys together.
Yeah. I think after about 60 interviews, I finally had my first sales book, which was New Sales Simplified by Mike Weinberg, which is a book that, remember, HubSpot would recommend that to us as the book, and it's a fantastic book. I've had about 50. It's an interesting question, and it takes me back to, I can remember a couple years ago, and actually an author who's been on the show a couple times, he saw me at a conference and he said, "Are you making money on your podcast?" And I said, "Not really, but that's not why I started it." So I guess in the podcast world, I'm not doing it right. Ideally, what you want to do is build a watering hole for the specific animal you want to hunt. You want to do something about that specific niche, and then maybe even interview prospective customers for your podcast. What I did was I did it for very personal reasons, and that's why I'm probably able to keep doing it. I came from a real advertising background. I worked at big agencies in New York City for a number of years, and then moved to Virginia, and 20 years ago started my own firm. And then it was real advertising focused for a long time. But a lot of that started to go away. You know, unfortunately, a lot of industries change if you stay in them long enough. And so I started to feel less and less relevant, and it really was bothering me probably more than most people. Like, for instance, having to bring a website person to a client meeting and hear them talk about SSL or, you know, some sort of servers or whatever. And I'm just thinking, or then they start asking about what was a fad, which is the internet and social media. Those are clearly fads that aren't going to. So anyway, my background was in advertising, and I just started feeling like I was kind of growing dinosaur scales. I didn't like that. And I went back to doing what I had done in grad school, which is, you know, reading a lot of books. And I stumbled upon David Maron Scott's, one of his early editions of The New Rules of Marketing and PR. And that really crystallized where the whole world was going because of the internet and technology and social media and all that type of things. So he's now up to his 7th edition in that book. And I felt like I had a second bite at the career apple, like, oh, I see where it's going. That led me to ultimately meet you at a HubSpot inbound conference. I started going in that direction. We buy very little advertising now for clients. We're doing a lot of content and that type of thing. But I remember thinking, I don't ever want to be in that situation again. I hated it so much. And so I had always been listening to podcasts. I always like listening to marketing podcasts. And I particularly like podcasts where they interviewed authors of books. And so along the way, I thought, well, you know, maybe I should try this. And so I started the podcast, and the first guest was David Merriman Scott. And I interviewed about the first 10, and I had already read all their books, and I had even met some of them at conferences, you know, like people like Ann Hanley or Joe Polizzi or Mark Schaefer, the really big time authors. They were very generous with their time. I got to about the 11th book, and I realized, wait a minute, I'm actually going to have to read each one of these books. It's like taking the wrong exit on the interstate and you realize you can't turn around for another 20 minutes. But it's fueled that desire that I have to want to try to keep up with what's going on. And in other words, it's like a regular program of doing it. So now I'm up to 320 something books and that have been on the show, and it's good. It you know, gives me some idea of what's going on. It's helpful for clients. It's helpful for me. It fills me with ideas. But the other thing that gets you going, and you'll find this as you continue to do your podcast, you start to hear from people, and they'll say to me, I hear from them now every week, and they'll say, hey, I've been listening to your show for a couple of years. Just want to say thanks. It's really been helpful, or it helped me get a promotion, or just these amazing things. And I'm thinking, ooh, man, I better take this more seriously. I didn't know the impact I was having on people. So now it's got over 2 million downloads, and it's in over 155 countries. And that's why I started it, but it's really more of a professional development as performance art, sort of a occupational hobby. It's not the main thing I do. And I'm not, there are some advertisers and I do need to charge them, but some of that has to do with my time that's involved. But otherwise, I probably, if you look me up in the dictionary under podcast monetization, there's probably not a picture of me as somebody who's doing it exactly right.
Oh, no, you still deserve a huge congratulations for getting to 300 plus episodes. I heard someone a couple of weeks ago talk about the term pod fade, where virtually everyone at some point drops off the cliff at 8 episodes, 20 episodes, 40 episodes, 100 episodes. That's amazing perseverance, amazing endurance, and sounds like it's been super helpful for professional development and building relationships.
Yeah, it is. And I have such admiration for these people who write these books. I'm sure you collect autographed Florida Marlins sports memorabilia, or maybe the Jets, I don't know, since you're from New Jersey. But I collect autographed marketing and sales books. And I have such admiration for these people that write these books. I don't want to write one. I'm too busy reading them. But it's just, it's so helpful. And I'm a person who, at a couple points in my career, read a book, particularly two books, that the right book at the right time can really, looking back, make a big difference. So if I can help people discover the right book at the right time, that's good. And that's why so many listeners contact me asking for book recommendations. They'll say, hey, I'm working on this, or I'm challenged on this particular area. Do you know of a book about that? And quite often I'm able to send them a link to an interview about the book, and they can listen to it and see if that might be helpful, or point them to whatever resource would be helpful for them.
Like a book concierge, like call down to the front desk sort of, and say, yeah, I'm looking for 4 new books to improve my craft this quarter. What do you recommend?
Yeah. Or like somebody like this week, somebody said, I'm going from becoming a speech pathologist, which I thought was a pretty good line of work, but she's going into marketing instead. And I said, oh, okay, I know just what book is she, you know, or somebody who's a more senior person, or they've just been assigned to a certain task force. And I'm like, gosh, thanks for listening. Have you read this one? You know, if I can, I don't want anyone else to have to read 350 books to find the right one or two for something that's going to help them right now. It only takes a few seconds. So it's kind of the fun thing I get to do during the day is hear from listeners and make a recommendation or point them in the right direction.
I think what's interesting too is in the 5, 6, 7 years or so that you've been hosting all these interviews, there's been such a dramatic shift in how people view formal education. Even before the pandemic, that big college scholarship scandal a couple of years ago, and tremendous amount of frustration over college debt and people rethinking, do I really, you know, $150,000 for an MBA? What's the ROI going to be on that? It's, you know, relatively easy for someone to find just a few hundred dollars a year to buy a very respectable library of books. Maybe they have an Audible subscription or getting them on Kindle.
Yeah. And you know, not that you asked, but that is so important. I want to mention something. There have been a few books over the years that were more about what marketers should be doing, like with their own career and to be successful, rather than a specific topic like Google Ads or Facebook advertising or content marketing or whatever. And several different studies and books talk about how the most successful marketers are the ones that have a learning mindset. In other words, they're always teaching themselves. And an even larger number of CEOs have that. Looking back over some study that started 40 or 50 years ago, they were very much into self-improvement, teaching themselves. And this is at a time when companies are spending less and less money training their employees, but there's never been a better time to learn. I mean, like even your audience, you know, they're probably pretty focused on learning something new and improving their results and their career. And there was a video I saw of Brian Halligan, one of the HubSpot founders, and the interviewer was asking I think it was a video about startup culture or something, and they've been enormously successful. And they said, what do you look for when you hire someone? And obviously at a marketing and sales software company like HubSpot, there are a lot of marketers there. What do you look for? And he said, the number one thing I look for is a learn-it-all. That's the number one thing they're looking for, is someone who, and they probably know how to tell, are they capable of teaching themselves something, figuring it out, and then going and doing it? I just thought that was fascinating, that was the number one thing that they look for now, because they're obviously in the technology space. Marketing is changing quite a bit. And you can imagine it goes really well with an entrepreneurial environment like that, but it's a learn-it-all, somebody who has demonstrated that they have the desire and the motivation to go teach themselves something. That's why I'm always telling the kids these days, go get some of those free HubSpot certifications or a Google certification, put it on your LinkedIn profile. That's a big differentiator.
Yeah, we were talking about this a couple of days ago. If you took a teenager in their junior, senior year of high school, and they were taking all of the free HubSpot certifications, and then you layered on a Coursera subscription, because Google has those programs now where there's five or six different certifications like project management and data analytics, where for $39 a month, 6 months later, you have a Google certificate. And then you really, really break the bank and you go get an executive certificate from a prestigious university and something that's really spot on. And those are like a whopping $2,500. That's going to be your highest budget expenditure. It's like all of a sudden, HubSpot certifications, Google program completion, and a digital analytics certification from MIT or Northwestern or Wharton or something like that, and total cost about $3,000. And you just have to wonder at some point, if you're the dean of a business, especially private schools, are you going to start getting a little nervous that disruption is right around the corner?
And I think that's going to happen faster than we expect. That's always the way it happens. You know, there's more and more people are like, what are we paying for? But here's just to add to that, the other side of that coin, say you're an employer and somebody comes through with that kind of unbelievable self-direction and motivation, you better snap them up. I would hope that they would know about writing. They would be good at writing or communicating, but even still, that whole course of action is very impressive.
Being that entrepreneurial, that resourceful to figure all of that out. You know, it's interesting too, to even just look at what HubSpot's trajectory has been with the whole investment in academy over the last decade, going from like one full-time to now a couple dozen full-time professors in multiple languages now. And if you go to their course catalog, like it's like trying to reach the end of the internet. I think there's a more discrete number of a few dozen certifications, but course-wise, it's in the hundreds. And I guess at some point, you know, originally, they started with the idea that they were training people to better utilize software, which for SaaS is super important, because if you don't use it, you don't get value and you don't stick. But they pretty quickly thereafter came to the conclusion that it was also super popular and important for people that weren't customers and may not be customers for a while.
Well, and think about it. Mark Killens, who you probably recall, he used to work at HubSpot Academy. He then went to Drift. I'm not sure where he is now. He may still be there. Is he still there? I remember once he was given a presentation and he showed a picture of a Major League Baseball pitcher and it said, teaching is the new pitching. And think about the experience that you give somebody by teaching them how to be more successful. Think about the trust that's built for that particular company and the authority that they must have. And when I was a HubSpot user group leader, I can remember there were a number of companies that would come or people came who weren't even using HubSpot. Like there was this one guy from a big tax preparation firm. I think he said he had 11 people in his department. They didn't use the HubSpot software, which is fine. And he said, every new hire, I make them take one of these two or three courses. Just because it was so valuable and it's free. Yeah. But that's a lot of goodwill that HubSpot builds up there. So, and it's such a great example of really effective content marketing. If you're helpful, you're going to get further than if you're talking about yourself.
They've a really interesting play too. They've explored in the last couple of years with getting more college professors to use their software in marketing graduate, undergraduate and grad courses. And lines were in college. I worked for IBM for 2 or 3 years on a program that was designed to give students and faculty members very aggressive discounts on what was back in the day, state-of-the-art IBM hardware, their PS2 systems in the early days of Windows. And Apple was neck and neck with them at the time and a few other hardware vendors. And the idea was you form all these brand affinities when you're 18, 19, 20 years old and your first time out. And all the consumer products companies were there at the same time. Phone cards.
I remember that.
Smartphones, consumer products, like the CD, the record CD music clubs.
Columbia House. Yeah. I remember having an AT&T card in school. Yeah. That's interesting. And I remember when that came out, because I have a relationship with the local university. I was hiring interns from there and I would go in and lecture every once in a while for some of the professors. And I remember sharing that with them. And some are receptive, some are not. I think some of them are kind of told what they need to teach. But I also, in the back of my mind, was wondering, were they threatened at all by this? I don't think so. But interestingly enough, I've started seeing Facebook ads from the local university on a digital certification.
Think about it, though. If you're sophomore, junior year in business school, you use HubSpot Marketing Enterprise for your course, but you get out and you go work for a small business that's about to install their first round of marketing automation, and you already know HubSpot well. Is Adobe even on the short list? Are you looking at SharpSpring? Are you looking at Infusionsoft? Are you looking at any of these other alternatives? Or you learned it so well that HubSpot got first
mover
advantage.
You're so comfortable with it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that there's a lot of, someone who's under 25, you go set that up. Like I can remember having a lunch a few years ago with this executive vice president of this big shipbuilding company, and they'd wanted to talk to me. And I remember he brought along to lunch this new marketing person. And she was a young, recent college grad and seemed very sharp. And I remember at one point during the conversation, he said, yeah, we hired her because she understands the Facebook thing. They weren't even using Facebook. And she looked at me and I was just sort of thinking like, can you blink twice if you're under duress? I know she needed a job. She had student debt probably to pay off and she was very sharp. And sure enough, she's not still there. So she got some experience and moved on to a place, but it was like, okay, if that's what you guys need, I'll do that for you. But it kind of saddened me that there are so many more senior people thinking that they're just such a blind spot as to what their marketing people could be doing for them and how they could be helping them.
I think in a lot of small companies, I see what I call premature abdication, where at a certain size, startup, scale up, small size, probably sub 50 employees, the CEO still really needs to be hands-on involved in the marketing and sales strategy because they just simply can't afford someone that's at a strong enough level with the digital marketing, marketing automation, sales enablement expertise, and knows their industry well enough to be able to completely punt it. But I usually tell when people come to me, they're like, I don't have time to spend time on this. I'm like, okay, well, the The most important thing is we have to figure out a way to position you as an expert, as a thought leader, as a subject matter expert, who in the company fits that role, because we can get it to the point where you can make a really big dent in an hour a week, but it's not an hour a year. And there's got to be somebody who has a ridiculous amount of institutional knowledge that needs to be captured. You know, all of that gets captured into video.
Probably more than one person.
And usually it should be a committee. And what makes me nervous is sometimes when they show up and they're selling to a market and there's no one in the company that checks off the box as being enough of an expert to feel comfortable with turning the webcam on and turning the microphone on in that
role.
But it's getting them thinking that the first goal with all of this isn't the tools, isn't the campaigns. It's strategy and content.
This is turning into a support group, and I thank you. Premature abdication, stealing it. I'll give you full attribution, of course, but that is so good. And there was a book on the show not too long ago, The Ultimate Guide to Google Ads. When you get up to episode 300 or whatever, I can really start to go out into some very specific areas. I had one on Facebook advertising. And even if you're not a Facebook advertiser or a Google advertiser, those are two fantastic books, because the people that are really successful at Facebook advertising and Google advertising are really good at marketing. And they have basically had the basics. They have the basics down. But there was in the Ultimate Guide to Google Ads, this was the Mike Rhodes. He has the largest Google ad agency in Australia. I think like the 18th largest in the world. And his last chapter was on hiring an agency. And he couldn't have been clearer. He said, please be careful outsourcing this, because there's a couple of reasons. One is you learn quite a bit about your customers and your company through Google advertising, in terms all the massive amounts of testing that you can do. But also, he was saying that, you know, the CEO or somebody, maybe a smaller company, they should try and do as much as they can, because they're going to learn so much and they should never relinquish it. In other words, maybe you work with an agency to help get you started, but try to get it back in-house as much as you can, because it's much more than just ads. You are learning in real time about your customers. So I thought that was interesting. I think it showed enormous authority and credibility and from him.
I actually listened to that the interview with Mike Rhodes.
You did?
On your podcast. Yeah. What's interesting is when I look at that entire category, the most dangerous area for a non-marketer that's hiring a Google ad specialist is when you're working with a small company and they're counting on that one person being their whole digital marketing solution. That person really has to have a good pulse on lead generation and segmentation and nurturing and personas and how this stuff impacts sales opportunities. And the more considerate of the sales process there is, the more heavy, high-ticket B2B it is, the more dangerous it is to just end up with someone that can handle the traffic, but can't connect the dots on everything else. And it's like putting together a baseball football team. It's like you really have to be able to spread that budget around to have good outfielders, good infielders, good starting pitchers, good relief pitchers. It's all in one place. It doesn't work very well in a small company.
Yeah. And I think that, humans want to find this, path of least resistance, simplest thing. And for a long time, there was a somewhat simple approach that worked for a lot of companies, which is just to buy advertising, because you had a somewhat more of a captive audience out there and you could kind of interrupt your way in. Of course, now you can't very easily interrupt what people are interested in. You have to be what people are interested in. And the companies there are a lot of companies that still are yearning for that. And they think, I just want a silver bullet. I just want a, I just want a nail for this one hammer that I have. And it's become, much more complex. And I think that it goes back to the four P's of marketing, which is, product, price, placement, distribution, and promotion. And so many still think of marketing as just promotion. And the truth is, marketing now is much more about how you run your company. Marketing is much more about the kind of people you hire and the experience that you give your customers. Frankly, people don't really believe what companies say about themselves. And, the experience that your customers have with you, the more that your customers can become your marketing, the faster you're going to get traction. But those aren't simple answers. And I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting is when sometimes when people come to me and they already have HubSpot, it's the most challenging possible situation because they're certain they already have the answer and they just need somebody who can press the buttons for them. And having to get them to reset and go back to the drawing board and think about what their actual go-to-market strategy is, who the personas are.
Why are you in business?
Where's all the content to load all of this stuff up? It's like, no, wait, I just need somebody to do that. I'm like, okay, then I might not be the right person for you if you just need a technician to press the buttons for you because you're too busy to press them yourself.
Well, and also, and I know I must sound like your dad, but you're making the right decision there because that never ends well. Because they don't know what they don't know. And perhaps worse, they don't have the humility to, you know, acknowledge that. And they're going to say, well, it reminds me years ago at some chamber of commerce function, some guy that owned an IT firm was talking about something on a panel. And he said, advertising doesn't work. I bought an ad once and nothing happened. That always stuck in my mind. And that is exactly who you were talking to. We hired a HubSpot person. How come I'm not minting money? We're laughing to keep from crying, just so your audience understands that.
In a sales leadership role too, it's equally challenging if there's not the humility there and the openness to new ideas. Because my position is, hey, look, you know, I'm investing 30, 40, 50 hours a year to keep my skills sharp on what I need to do to support a sales team at your size. Can I at least get you to watch the intro to inbound marketing from HubSpot Academy so you kind of sort of get what we're really trying to do here? It's a challenge.
Yeah. But that's, you know, our friend Marcus Sheridan, that's good assignment selling because, you know, in sales, no should be your second favorite word. And the faster you can find that out, you probably save yourself a year or more of heartache and a bad ending.
I think the interesting outcome that a lot of people don't think of in a startup in the first couple of years of their business is if you can just get the activity going to get them closer to product market fit faster or go to market fit faster, a lot of times they get some very interesting outcomes because if they do the content and the ebooks and the webinars and podcasts, if they do all of that stuff right, they get fans of people that fall in love with their content before they even know what the company does to the point where when they get to the meeting and they're actually talking about their product or service, if they get someone who isn't going to become closed one, the second best outcome is, hey, Douglas, I love what this is about, but you're missing this key feature. And if you added that, I'd sign up yesterday and I have five friends in other companies in similar roles who would also sign up. And when you walk away with that and you realize that like they just gave you $100,000 worth of or $1 million worth of free consulting there as the consolation prize for not closing them now. They told you exactly what you need to get with your product manager, get with your engineer, build and come back to them in a couple of months and say, okay, now try.
Yeah. It's like you had my phones tapped because years back as I was transitioning away from advertising to digital marketing, I was blogging and I was downloading things and, you know, linking to whatever blog post or landing page was. So I was just talking about these different resources. And along the way, I downloaded some stuff from HubSpot. And then a month or so, I can't remember, it was in summer, I saw the caller ID, somebody calling, and normally we can't answer the phone anymore because it's usually somebody trying to bother us, and it said HubSpot, and I answered it. And they said, hey, Douglas, we saw you downloaded the stuff from our website. Did you find what you were looking for? And I said, yeah. And basically the conversation went, I love that stuff on your site. I have no idea what you guys do, but I really like all the stuff on your site. And they laughed and said, yeah, we hear that a lot. Could we tell you what we do? I said, yeah, what do you guys do? I like you. Well, a week later, I was a customer. And so that's, you know, that's one nature of how it works. But there were three books come to mind. If a lot of your listeners are interested in the startup world, and I can provide you with the links to these interviews, but there were a couple of books that were, I wish every startup would read. And one of them was called The Ultimate Startup Guide by Tom Hogan and Carol Broadbent, a couple of Silicon Valley startup marketing agency. And I think they only work with companies that are VC funded now. They've done very well, but it was funny. And they explained where so many startups get it wrong and where they get it right. And the very funny thing in that book at the very beginning, they talked about how the legend of Steve Jobs was the worst thing to happen to startup culture because so many clueless CEOs thought they were supposed to behave that way. He was a unicorn, okay? And then there was another book called Beyond Product by Jill Soley. She's a Silicon Valley marketer. And it was, again, that was a short book. And she explained this idea of, you know, product market fit in a way that was so crystal clear. And every week she's having to explain this to people who have a lot of money. And these are experienced executives, a lot of engineers, obviously, and they don't quite understand where they're going wrong. And I remember reading that book thinking, do you really run into this a lot? And she said, all the time. It's just a massive blind spot. And there was a third book by, you probably have heard of the book Predictable Revenue by Aaron Ross and Mary Lou Tyler. So Aaron Ross then wrote a book after that with Jason Lemkin called From Impossible to Inevitable. And he's in the startup world, all that sort of thing. And those two guys wrote this book, no theory at all. They say these are the seven things that every hyper-growth company gets right. And he actually came on the show to talk about the second edition of the book. Fantastic book. Fantastic. But those were three that they were so clear. And I think all the authors felt like they were probably taking crazy pills for their whole career because they were having to explain the same thing over and over again. But it's just what you were talking about, product market fit and several other things.
Yeah, I come across Aaron Ross quite regularly. He puts out great content. He has a company that does outsourced sales development and building calling-based mm-hmm. campaigns. He came from, was an early Salesforce hire. He puts out great content in that area. And Jason Lemkin has that whole Saster conference community, which has been a little more virtual the last year, but I'm sure he's looking forward to it being a more traditional. And he does great podcasting content, great video content as well with entrepreneurs and sales leaders and marketing leaders from software companies. All good stuff to try to figure out to connect the dots. One of the interesting areas that I've had to lean into the last couple of years as well is like, no matter how successful your marketing campaigns are, sales isn't supporting and they're not calling the leads and they're not calling them with the right frequency and with the right mindset to aim to help. Getting that alignment right is super critical. And then marketing and sales can do everything right, but if the product isn't solid enough and delivering on all the great work that marketing and sales did to get somebody to close one, then there becomes a retention and monetization problem. So I think Mark Roberge really got it right when he said, when you're looking for your first sales hire, get someone that's startup experienced because they'll be used to working in the extreme uncertainty where mm-hmm. they didn't walk in and they weren't the 500th salesperson hired who was on version 37 of the playbook. They were there when they had to figure it out and realize that part of their job is listening for product management type of information and relaying that back to the team about what's missing and what it takes and being, you know, very entrepreneurial internally.
Yeah. His book, Sales Acceleration Formula, was just fascinating because he talked about, being the first director of sales at HubSpot when they started. And he was an engineer. He'd never had any sales training, although we both know his dad is a sales trainer. So maybe there was a genetic thing, but it was so fascinating to just like any entrepreneur or startup person was like, I've never been in sales. That's okay. Just do it anyway. So he approached it like a mechanical engineer, which he is. And what was interesting is they would test people. You know, you test salespeople, evaluate them, see if they've got some of the qualities and skills. And so they got going. And then, of course, after a certain amount of time, he went back and looked at the ones that were doing really well to see which of the 12 traits they scored high and low for. And the ones that were doing really well actually were people that didn't exhibit very good closing technique. You know, in other words, I can't remember exactly what they were, but like they were very good listeners.
Curious and coachable, right? Or open to
something like that.
And gave them feedback and they were able to run with it.
And they were selling a product people didn't really understand. It wasn't like there were a sea of 10,000 sales and marketing software companies like there are now. Yeah, that was just fascinating.
Very different to be selling HubSpot as a brand, as SaaS. 15, 16 years into the company's history compared to like doing year one, year two, year three, where nobody had ever heard of the company or inbound marketing, why they should even pay attention to any of this.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure that's why so many of the early employees have done so well.
Going on to other things. He's had an interesting trajectory too. He teaches sales at Harvard Business School and he's a VC now for SaaS mm-hmm. companies, helping to rethink the whole model to get the success rate up much higher than it currently is.
Yeah, and hats off to Harvard for having a guy like that, you know, on the faculty. There's not much sales taught in schools.
No, I come across it every once in a while where there's like competitions and like clubs around that, but it's definitely not a mainstream thing where you hear of someone, oh, I decided instead of majoring in marketing, I'm going to major in sales. Maybe there needs to be in certain schools because you just, it's the challenge with all of this is what you thought you knew 5 or 10 years ago is largely very irrelevant today.
Yes. And I remember in Mark's interview, I can't remember if he said this in the book, but he said, the problem with salespeople is that after they've been in sales 2 years, they don't want to learn anything new. And I thought, whoa, strong words. He goes, no, I've seen it, you know? And so, and that's a problem. Like you talked about, like, let's say, and again, you know, in the marketing agency world, there's been a number of times where we would do everything right from a marketing standpoint, but they weren't following a sales process. And then they would blame us, which is why at some point a couple of years ago, I just said, all right, that's it. We're not going to work with any more companies if they don't have the other stuff squared away. And if we have to help get them squared away first, we're going to do that. Because they think, oh, let's just do some marketing. It reminded me of what he said about some folks, they're being resistant. And actually, Marcus Sheridan talks quite a bit about this because he does a lot of sales training and helping people come around to a more modern approach to helping customers that you're selling to. And in Mark Hunter's book, A Mind for Sales, the second time he was on the podcast, he talked about how there was this one client where he was doing sales training. And they said, Mark, there are these two young guys, and we want you to spend a little time with them and find out what they're doing, because they actually thought they were doing something illegal because they were selling so much. These were younger guys. And he said, okay, I'll, you know, it's not what he was there for, but sir, I understand, you know. And it turned out they were completely legal. They were spending a lot of time with marketing. They were talking to them all the time. They were, you know, collaborating with them. They were giving marketing ideas. They were getting ideas back from marketing. They were providing a lot of helpful content that marketing had been producing, and they were crushing it from a sales standpoint. I thought that was a very funny story. And they were like the two youngest employees too.
This is what we're doing now is part of the muscle that modern sales professionals need to be taken seriously, being good on video, being good in moderating webinars and podcasts and good with using video as a report. And the interesting thing too is one of the silver linings of what we've gone through over the last year is I think it's forced people to become more comfortable, but I think it's also dialed back the perfectionism that I used to see with companies where they felt like, oh, we can't get started with video. We don't have the budget to bring in a professional videographer for $2,000 per day. I'm like, no, you can start like with what you have. If you want to get really fancy, buy a better microphone, get a little better lighting or something like that. But you know, that's a few hundred dollars and you own all that stuff. But the bigger thing is the mindset shift of just starting and realizing that it's all about providing value.
Yep. And just to add to that, if you're too slick, I think it hurts. And there were, again, I read all these books, so I keep thinking like, oh. But the 300th episode with Jeb Blunt, I think it was the fifth time I interviewed him. He's one of the most prolific sales authors, and he wrote an entire 300-page book on virtual selling. Now, what was interesting, though, is it's like he snuck in a really good sales book and everything under the guise of virtual, but it included all the other things you need to be doing, like getting on the phone and all these other kinds of things. But the other thing that was so interesting about his book is that everything that we're doing in this pandemic from a sales standpoint, virtual selling, we're still going to be doing 4 years from now. We may still get to go visit people, but I think that a lot of people are thinking we don't need to go see a prospect as soon as they express some interest, maybe a little later in the sales process. You know, the idea of, oh, let's get a team on the airplane and go meet these people. No, maybe, you know, further down your sales process. But there was another book, back to Marcus, he wrote a book called The Visual Sale with Tyler Lessard from Vidyard, and it was one of those books where you just can't argue with the logic. And he just explains, look, this is working really, really well, getting on a Zoom call, and you can use video to make buying from you much easier than people realize.
I think too, once investors and board members get wind of the fact that so many deals are able to close without getting the team on a plane and spending 10, 20, 30 grand to go out and do an in-person pitch, it's going to change the dynamics. I've heard Kevin O'Leary mention it a bunch of times also, that once he saw it actually work, are really people going to go back to doing this? There may be a small sliver of your market that does need the FaceTime. The question is, does the client acquisition cost versus the lifetime value really justify it? And what's interesting is, in the space we live in, where you look at SaaS at the price point that like HubSpot sells to small and medium-sized businesses, they knew 8 or 10 years ago that it wasn't going to be a model that supported field sales. And part of the reason I think they hit the tipping point with their IPO and the crazy trajectory they're on is they figured that out pretty early on. It's like there's natural demarcation points where price point is so low that you really can't afford inside sales. And then there's a much wider band where you can afford inside sales, but you can't afford outside sales. You got to wonder now, post-pandemic, how big the deal size, how big the lifetime value needs to be to justify still doing field sales. Instinctively, it probably feels like at least 6 figures. Like somehow magically, a lot of these deals in the 5-figure range have been very closable over Zoom and e-signatures.
Yeah, but you know, they've had outbound sales ever since the beginning. They have a whole floor of people doing outbound sales. When I interviewed Mike Weinberg about that new sales simplified, he is one of the several sales authors who is deeply irritated by people that promote this idea that you don't need to sell anymore, that customers will just come to you, that deals will somehow close themselves, which is not true. Salespeople will always be needed, particularly good salespeople selling complicated things. And in that interview, I said, well, you know, outbound, or HubSpot does outbound selling. And he wasn't aware of that. Yeah. And he said, oh man, I appreciate you saying that, because I'm going to be talking about that a lot. Because, not so much in his book, but when he goes out into the world and he's giving talks and he's doing training, that company kept coming up. Well, pretty quickly he was able to say, look, guys, that's a fantasy that you're longing for, that people are just going to call you up and wire you money. You got to have a sales team.
It's e-commerce.
HubSpot has one.
Yeah. HubSpot does inbound and outbound, and the outbound fits really nicely with account-based marketing and target accounts. At a certain size, it I think can be engineered with like product-led growth, where someone, they have a $49 a month offering, or somebody's buying Dropbox or Google Apps or simple web hosting or something, and by necessity almost needs to be something that people can self-serve on. And then there's a wider band at a few hundred or a few thousand dollars where you definitely need some figuring out. The challenge for a lot of B2B tech companies I see is, if people are purchasing without being vetted and qualified, you could have a situation where someone signs up and they churn really quickly because they were never a fit in the first place. So shifting that responsibility to the sales team of making sure that they've properly managed expectations and properly vetted, and making sure that there's a smooth handoff from sales into onboarding and customer success, and ultimately the salesperson having some responsibility.
And yeah, I remember in Mark Roberge's book, he talked about how they were wrestling with that, like, ooh, the churn is, we're making the sales, but we're really churning more than we should. And as I recall, they were thinking, oh, what should we do? And they said, look, you're going to get some compensation when you make a sale, but you're going to get what, like most of it, or at least half, when they renew after 1 year. And he said it was almost like overnight they were getting better customers.
And I remember they engineered tracking into the products, and that's something a lot of SaaS companies are doing now also, where they know that there's a certain usage where you've crossed the threshold and like, okay, you're 90% likely to stick now, because vice versa, on the flip side of like, you're 2 weeks in, 4 weeks in, 60 days in, and you haven't hit that milestone and you're not using the product at all, you're probably an extremely high risk. That's the whole idea too, of where you have these annual payments or annual contracts. You really don't know, if you're not looking at the product, whether you really have a healthy relationship or not. You can get fooled pretty quickly on the financial side, and the investors love that. But the flip side is, if the product utilization isn't there, it's just masking the real problem.
Yeah. And that's where a couple of books that have been on the show over the years were so interesting. One was The Membership Economy by Robbie Kelman Baxter, and also like Subscription Marketing by Ann Janser, and Subscribe by Teen Zuo, where what's interesting, and what so much of the subscription-based companies are hopefully teaching the rest of the world, is that it's not just about getting the customer, it's about keeping the customer. So a large part of their marketing is to their customers to make sure they can keep them. And I can't think of even a non-subscription business would do well to pay more attention to their customers, keeping their customers, than trying to get new ones that are going to leave after a year.
I saw that happen in spades in the hardware and software business. If you think about the entrepreneur who started up their business 30 years ago in the heyday of people building out client server networks and Novell network and things like that, and offices, and selling them a lot of routers and switches and servers. That
equipment.
Traditional sales professional, a lot of them had a really hard time shifting to selling managed services and cloud services on a recurring basis, because it was such a different diagnostic process, such a different exploratory process, consultative process, and completely changed the dynamics of the skill set that would work. And what's interesting is a lot of the attrition just simply happened because so many of the people that were hitting that inflection point were near retirement age. So some of it forced attrition with replacement. You know, you weren't going to hire somebody who was in their mid-20s or who was going to face the same resistance to, hey, I want to do it the same way I've done this for the last 30 years of my career. But it's been interesting challenges too to watch all of that happen. The consumerization of IT and a lot of IT decisions being shifted out the line of business managers throughout organizations, decentralized IT changed the dynamics of that too.
Yeah, it may seem like a subtle difference, but it's an enormously different mindset. You know, they were actually having to pay attention to their customers. That's a very interesting thing. And you're going to probably see more and more of subscription-based products. There's even in the book Subscribed, which is really well done, they talked about earth-moving equipment. You can buy subscriptions to earth-moving equipment. So in other words, I think it was Caterpillar is doing it. And they realized, I mean, you still buy their equipment if you want, it makes sense for you. But with subscription, you have to think doubly hard about what is it that people are buying from us. They're not buying a subscription. They're buying a solution to a problem. So in the case of these massive earth-moving companies, these were companies that were buying these big vehicles. They were paying to have earth moved. And they kind of knew how much they needed moved. So they just bought a subscription saying, we want this many, you know, cubic yards of earth moved every month. And the Caterpillar was like, sure, we'll have everything for you there. Just pay us a subscription and we will move that earth for you. And we'll do it on time. And you won't have to worry about equipment. You won't have to worry about employees. You don't have to worry about insurance. You just pay us. I just thought that was fascinating. The things that people are subscribing to now.
CFOs love to talk about, and even the salespeople that sell this type of business model love to talk about shifting from capital expenditures, CapEx, to operating expenditures, OpEx, because there's all different implications to how you measure. And I think a lot of the seeds for this were getting planted as software as a service and cloud services became more popular. But I just heard Dell talking about this a few months ago too, that they envision that the whole future of the company will largely be people subscribing to hardware as opposed to purchasing hardware. So it'll look more like a car lease to a certain degree, with a certain end of life and a certain refresh cycle. Some of the phone plan companies too have already shifted to that, where you're paying monthly with a guaranteed refresh when you realize that, oh wow, you know, my iPhone is 2 years old, it's really ancient now, of course I want the new one. And instead of having to buy it, they just have you pay a fixed fee per month, and okay, they'll take it back, they'll refurbish it, they'll do something else with it and get the new iPhone model.
Yeah, they're selling connectivity, they're not selling phones.
Different business, you know? The jobs to be done.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
Exactly.
So kind of, and pulling this all together, where do you think B2B as a focus for companies is headed in the next 2, 3, 4 years? What do you think we're going to look back on now and realize that something dramatic had changed, that flipped the switch, that really made such a big difference on how companies were selling to other businesses?
Well, for the rest of our working years, it's going to be interesting to see the after effects of the pandemic. What changes did it speed up? Like, you're talking about education, healthcare. Do you need to travel 3 hours to see the doctor if you're feeling fine, but they wanted to follow up with you? So from I guess from a B2B marketing standpoint, one of them we already talked about is the way that I think customers are going to be more inclined to want to get with you on the on a Zoom call than have you come see them. You know what I mean? Like, can we just meet that way instead of having you come out here? I think people expect that, are going to expect that more. I think also, you know, when we're so awash in content and there's so many distractions and we're able to tune out so much more than we used to every month, we can probably tune out more things that we don't want. I think the silver lining there is that companies are realizing that they really do have to focus more on the true motivations of their customers and what's interesting to their customers, because they're getting tired of being invisible. So if all they're talking about is their products and their services, which is not really the way to go, it's focusing more on the customer. And you know, the most successful companies, and this is recurring through so many of the books that I've read, the most successful companies are the ones that understand their customers just a little bit better than their competitors. And when they do understand them, a couple things happen. One is you break through because you think, oh, they get me. They actually kind of understand what I'm doing. And you sense that they're empathizing with you. But also, when you understand your customers just a little bit better than your competition, you don't have to be perfect at this. It's like what you were talking about earlier. They will start to tell you what you need to do to be successful. And that kind of brings to mind another book, Content Inc. by Joe Polizzi, where he talked about all these companies that built an audience first. And then basically they were told, this is what I want. This is what I need. And so if you, the company, it's hard for companies to do. Believe it or not, empathy seems to be the hardest yet most important word in marketing and sales, because you know humans are kind of self-oriented. But I think that more and more people might start to understand that. It also kind of brings to mind that notion you had about the IT guys that have been there for 30 years. It's like, okay, maybe some more folks are going to retire, and maybe some younger people will come along, and more digital natives who just understand the fallacy of taking the old approach. There was a book on the show a while back called Sell the Way You Buy. It was by an ex-Salesforce guy who was a sales manager, and he was telling his people to do a certain thing, and then he realized he hated it when people were doing it to him. So he changed it all up and realized, you know, that not only were what his people were doing is wrong, irritating, it wasn't really very successful. So I think there's more people that are going to start to understand that. So I don't know. The only thing I know about the future is that I know is going to happen is that everyone will have flying cars, entire meals will come in pill form, and the world will be ruled by damn dirty apes. I should disclose that I'm quoting Austin Powers. That was his prediction on the future. And actually every year there's there's people that write these blog posts like, what are your predictions for the next year? And I always respond with that, and they never come back to me again because I just don't think these prediction roundups are, you know, always very, very helpful. But it's an interesting question. I think a lot of people aren't asking about that. But I think that people, the most successful companies are going to be the ones that are better at using technology to connect on a more human level.
Bezos mentioned that a few times in interviews, that when it comes to his daily routine, he's not working on what's going to make or break Amazon's quarter now. He's working on what's going to be relevant to Amazon's performance 24, 36 months out. And great for companies to have that luxury. And I guess it really depends on where you are with your competitive positioning and size and capital and what the role of a CEO looks like in being able to read the tea leaves, the customer insight, and think about the future and entirely new business models.
You know, another thing that he has said, I've seen him quoted as saying he doesn't know what's going to happen in the future. He's pretty candid about that. But what he's said that he tries to focus on are, what are the things that aren't going to change? And that's worked really well for him. Like, people want low prices, they want fast delivery, they want guarantees, they want more frictionless experience. That could be free returns or one-click buying or whatever. But he's found it really helpful to also try to focus. I mean, obviously you want to see what's where things are going, but what are the kind of universal truths that customers aren't going to change? And those are, I think, largely things that go back to our prehistoric brain days, the sort of some of the most basic human motivations.
Trust is a big one. I think there's still, that will still be a barrier for businesses for generations to come. And if anything, it'll be harder and harder for companies to overcome it.
Yeah, very true. And, you know, it's like one of those questions that people could ask internally at a company, like, is the decision we're about to make, is that going to build trust or subtract trust from our prospects and customers? You know, is it going to add to or detract from their customer, their opinion of dealing with us, the experience?
Part of the bank account.
Yeah. Yeah.
Friends keep from either give you points or take away points, whether you know about the analytics that goes on in people's brains of how they make decisions and how they navigate their choices.
Yeah, it's true. Was it Vince Lombardi, I think it said, there's no such thing as being on time. You're either early or you're late. I saw this in a book that talked about the same concept, which is there's no such thing as meeting customer expectations. You're either exceeding them or you're not exceeding them. You're not meeting them. I thought that was an interesting idea.
Customer expectations are going to continue to increase. People expect companies to have superpowers. Everything that they've experienced on the customer side, they'll eventually demand on the business-to-business side. And companies have to wake up to the importance of customer of CX, of customer experience.
Yeah, folks may have heard of the thing called the Amazon effect. There was a book on the show called Marketing to the Entitled Consumer, Dave Franklin, who lives in Palm Beach. And ex-Forrester guy, great book. And he talked about how what you just said, regardless of what your industry is doing, don't pay attention to what your competition is doing, because your competitors may suck. If they have a good experience with some other industry, they expect it from you, whether you can do it or not. Like, for instance, you buy something, you expect an email update saying, we got your message, we got your order, or we finally shipped your order, or your order is going to arrive that day. Just simple things like that. Don't make them go and chase that. And so, you know, all these other companies are like, yeah, nobody else does that. That doesn't matter. Your customer has experienced something good elsewhere. They want that from you now. And I think there's a lot of things that have happened in this pandemic where people are thinking, well, why can't you bring it out to my car? You brought my meals out to the car. Why can't you bring the couple of bags of sod or whatever out to my trunk?
We mulched last weekend, and my sister and brother-in-law were shocked that it's possible to get a pallet of mulch delivered to the house. And yes, it's possible to get a pallet of mulch delivered. And
oh, wow.
It's probably is for unskilled, relatively unhandy folks like ourselves. If you can move the bag and cut it open with scissors and dump it and rake it, you're 90% of the way there to being able to self-mulch. But yes, these are the things you can
do
on your phone. Yeah.
No, yeah, now you've added stuff to my weekend list. Yeah, gosh, because I'd always thought, oh, I don't want to carry those things. And otherwise you have to hire a company and they dump a big pile of it on a tarp on your driveway. It's like, oh, interesting. I didn't
we have
and actually
SUV
that probably works probably out even better for the seller, because yeah, they're saving on space, and it's a high volume, it's a high dollar purchase too.
We would have probably had to make 4 or 5 trips back and forth to the store to pick up 10 or 20 bags at a time. And this got it all done. And
interesting.
Totally contactless. But yeah, these are all just all the crazy that our car came up for, at least came up for renewal, and it was done 100% without going to the showroom anymore. I guess it helped that we've stuck with the same dealer year after year. So there was that trust already. But yeah, it was everything was all done and was just delivered to the driveway, and we signed the papers in the driveway.
Okay, so now you're going to expect that every time.
Every time. Why?
That's what you were talking about.
It changes. Definitely changes perception. Cool. Well, Glugs, thanks so much for joining me for this episode. It's been super informative. I think you gave a tremendous reading list to our listeners to fill their shelves and virtual shelves and Kindles up with, keeping up with best practices for what it means to be successful with marketing and sales. I know you're active on LinkedIn. Is that the best place for someone to connect with you or follow more about
what
you're doing?
Okay. I go on LinkedIn probably more than anything else. I go on Facebook and Twitter just to see if somebody's left me a message. In fact, I have a Chrome plugin on Facebook called Newsfeed Eradicator for Facebook, which erases the newsfeed. But I can go in, because that's very seductive. You know, they very smart people at Facebook. They want to pull you in. It's blank. It'll have like a quote from Maya Angelou instead. But I can see if somebody's leaving a message. But on LinkedIn, Douglas Burdett. But what I was going to suggest was that, as I say to my listeners, if I can help you from having to read 350 books by recommending like one or two that kind of might scratch the itch that you have, please get in touch with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I'll do my best to, you know, send you a link to an interview about a book that I think might help you, or one I haven't interviewed the author about, or any other kind of resource. And the only thing I ask is that please include a message. Say something like, I saw you on Josh's show. Let's connect. That's all I ask, because I'm getting what seems to be an awful lot of spam LinkedIn connections on LinkedIn these days. So maybe LinkedIn will figure that out. But if I can help point you to that. Otherwise, go to marketingbookpodcast.com and you can find some of the, I think it's funny, it's on HubSpot naturally. I think it only goes back the last 200 episodes that'll show. you can't hit a button and see all of them. But yeah, either LinkedIn or Marketing Book Podcast. I'm on Twitter, I'm Marketing Book. But if I can help folks find the right book or resource, do connect with me on LinkedIn, and I'll see what I can write a book prescription. I mean, even in this conversation, you would bring up an idea or a concept, and I'd say, oh, in this book, they talked about that or that. So it's like my grandfather and uncle were pharmacists. And maybe it's genetic. It's like, I want to write prescriptions. I want to write book prescriptions for people. It's like, oh no, I know just the book you need to read right now. So I enjoy doing that. So if any of your audience wants to do that, happy to connect.
That's the repositioning of every aspirational trusted advisor and sales professional, is the doctor-patient relationship. As you ask your prospects what their symptoms are, and you prescribe, you identify, connect, and explore before you advise, as opposed to showing up and demoing first.
Which reminds me of the I still go to sales training once a week. They can't get rid of me now. I reached a certain point at sales training where I didn't have to pay anymore, and now I've probably maybe over 15 years now. But it's a great class, and there's a joke that I've heard where the guy goes to the car dealership, and they say, "Hi, what brings you here?" And the person says, "Well, I'd like to buy a car." And the salesperson says, "Have I got the car for you?" No question, you know, no diagnosis, nothing. You're not supposed to do that, in case any of your audience doesn't know that. So, well, good. Well, it's great. Great catching up with you.
Likewise.
And I hope things go well with the show. Let me know what I can do to help promote it.
Sure. Appreciate that. Thanks so much, Douglas. Appreciate it. Take care now and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the B2B Digitized Podcast. To subscribe and leave a review, check us out at b2bdigitized.com or wherever you like to consume podcast episodes, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and YouTube.